This podcast is brought to you by the new term at fxphd.com. Hand in hand with FX Guide, our training site FXPhd allows you to do online training with the benefit of industry professionals to guide you. This new April term includes training in Nuke 7, Hero, editing, grading, lens tech, and even maths for VFX. Check it all out at fxphd.com. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour. This week we are going to Oblivion. Well, we're looking at it anyway, discussing it and breaking it apart, looking at the visual effects and working out what works, what doesn't, and what we loved and what we didn't about this sci-fi film that I certainly tweeted that I really, really enjoyed. And to join me on the program, starting with from your home, aren't you, Matt? Matt Wallen?
Yes, indeed. I'm at home here in Virginia, hanging out in the darkness of a cold, rainy, I guess, what is it, spring, right? Evening.
Because it's fairly dark where you are, it's very light where I am, and normally those two are running in opposite sides as we are on the other side of the planet. Also joining us is Ty. Ty Rubin, how are you, sir?
Doing very well. Glad to be here.
You are slightly less dark where you are, I believe.
Yes, we're already setting into the summer. I think we hit 95 this week. So,
yikes!
Getting ready to be the desert as the desert is meant to be.
Right. Yes. Whereas, of course, where I am is still pretty sunny and perky and jolly nice. Thank you very much. So, I said I liked this film. I thought it was a really interesting film. I was pleased that it gave me something that wasn't just a comic book reenactment. Certainly it wasn't a reimagining of Oblivion, the film that I saw 10 years ago. So I liked it. I was really happy with what I saw. But Ty, what did you think?
Well, I had a little bit of a mixed feeling about it myself. I was very much looking forward to it. I thought it was visually really slick, and it had a real sex appeal that I noted right away from when I first started seeing the press materials. And then when I saw the trailer, I was really excited to see it. And I would have to say that watching the film was enjoyable, but I felt like the storyline and the payoff was a little bit off the mark for me. I kind of felt underwhelmed at the end of the day by the way that the story turned. And I would say that that was kind of amplified by the experience of the Tom Cruise character going out to see the powerful intergalactic machine that had come to Earth and caused all this havoc. I felt like that I was waiting for that payoff to be, on par with some of the previous visuals, the earlier visuals. And to me, it just seemed like it kind of sputtered out. Had some echoes of other things that I'd seen before, and the notion of what had gone on in that space, factory basically, or space attack machinery, it just seemed like it was underwhelming, black against black, and it kind of left a disappointing taste in my mouth. And so I would have to say that as much as I admired a lot of the great, fantastic work in it, for me as an audience goer, it didn't really, as they say, push all my buttons.
What about you, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think, that's a pretty good summary. I would say, I so want to like the work of this director, of Joseph Kosinski. I think, if you go to his website, josephkosinski.com, you can view a lot of like the commercials and like game trailers and stuff that he'd done before he did even the previous big film he did, right, the Tron Legacy film. And I really like his aesthetic sensibility, his sort of playing against type that he'll do in a lot of his commercial work that he's done. And I think he has a good aesthetic sensibility, which I think was demonstrated in large measure in this film as well as in the Tron film. And of course, you got a great DP on this project as well as on Tron with Claudio Miranda, right? And then Tom Cruise, you know, is usually worthy of a admission to a film, but I kind of felt the same. I felt like, you know, when it's all said and done, like, you know, Morgan Freeman, I guess, was in this movie, right, for like 5 minutes. I don't remember much of what he had to offer. He was sort of an unused character. I thought I had some issues with the there's the female controller, the, you know, are you an effective team? And she has her kind of like, you Victoria. Know, sort of really over the top Southern accent, you know, the woman who is, they're going to see her or whatever, right? Who, not the redheaded woman, but the woman who was like, you know, the one who was always monitoring them.
Right? And, Sally?
Sally, yeah. And I thought that there was something about that characterization that was just, it took me out of the film every time she was on screen. Even in the trailer when she spoke her lines, it was so false. Maybe that was its intent.
Was,
I don't
yeah,
know.
I think but, we should say a huge spoiler alert that if you haven't really picked
oh,
this
yeah.
up, yeah, please stop listening if you haven't seen this, because we are going to have to completely shatter to
but
discuss
it. But it was like, it felt like I was watching a movie that, you know, had all the right pieces of the puzzle in place except for the story, which I thought in the end was, it just didn't deliver the goods. It was like, I was saying to a friend afterwards, I felt like I watched Duncan Jones Moon with a splash of Inception and a little bit of Steven Soderbergh's Solaris mixed in. And I watched this kind of hybrid movie that never really achieved the success of really any one of those other three movies.
So my mix was Moon, Wall-E, and Independence Day for the ending.
Oh, yeah, yeah, there you go. That's perfect for the ending, for sure. So, yeah, I mean, I think all in, I would say it's worthy of a matinee price. I think, you know, if you like science fiction, I would go see it. You know, I went and saw it, not just for the show. I wanted to go see this picture, even if I wasn't going to do this episode of the VFX show. I really wanted to go see this film because, I don't know, I'm hungry for always for a good kind of mature, beautiful looking science fiction picture, and I think, you know, it was fun, but in the end, like, I think it missed a few moments where it could have been a stronger film overall.
Yeah, I think I liked it a bit more than you guys. I don't think it's a, you know, instant sci-fi classic. I don't think it's moved me to ways like Moon did, where I was just, oh my god, what, you know, you have to see this to us, but I was grabbing friends and sort of shoving DVDs at them. But I thought it was good. And also, I do understand the point about the whole alien ship thing, though it felt like if you wanted to handle that, or for that matter, what was sounded like a really interesting precursor, the fight that got them to this point, where all the different Jacks came down and waged war in the first place, that would be, you know, the sequel in front of this and the sequel after it and the prequel in front of it. So I thought you could have, if you had a whole big space battle thing at the end, it would have felt like a whole different movie tacked on. So I sort of responded to the discipline of keeping it to what was this sort of smaller story down on the planet. But it must have been hard, because the temptation is to just do the big, you know, destruction porn, sim sequency kind of massive battle in space thing. And I don't know, I would have applauded it any more if it had done that. But I take your guys' point. Can we switch to the visual effects then? And let's discuss industrial design first. And Ty, I'd love your opinion on the hydro towers and the drones, because these are pivotal parts of the story.
Yeah, I thought that it's I know that the bubble ship design was Daniel Simon, right? I thought that it was a really fantastic science fiction vehicle. I really can't praise the bubble ship design enough. I thought that it had the feeling of a believable technological system, but yet one that's, you know, presently out of reach for us. But it kind of had the signature of things that you would believe are coming down the pipe. You know what I mean? It had like clear visibility, which is always a big deal when you're, you know, dealing with VTOL kinds of aircraft, or so it had that whole kind of helicopter front bubble thing. The flight system itself looked like some kind of hybridized jet system with those round spheres, and then of course how the landing gear operated was really sweet. You know, it operated with minimal moving parts, but it kind of folded back for flight position, folded forward for landing, and then the fact that they built a full scale one. I happen to know Kevin Ishioki. I know is the senior art director on that show, and he and I worked together on Avatar. And I think that he and his team, however that shook out specifically, made just a beautiful prop. You could tell by the way that they could shoot it from all these various angles. That, you know, it was a quality set piece, and they used it well. And then the way that that allowed for the intercutting between the cockpits and the ship and flight. That said, I think I was less in love with the drones. I think that if you looked at all the care that went into Bubble Ship, a little bit of it was missing in the thinking for the drones, primarily in the way that the propulsion system was set up. There wasn't really, in my mind, any way that those pods could hover. You would have needed some forward thrusting kind of component that would counteract the rear thrusting. And when the rear jet turned into its down position, it never actually was on center of the mass of the drone. Now, this is all crazy, too complicated, so I'm not trying to be a bubble burster on that particular one. But when you look at the fidelity of how they managed to make this future reality look so credible, I didn't feel that the drones had that. I also felt that there was, and I'm a huge fan, as you well know, of 2001 Space Odyssey, and I think that there was an homage to the pod that is used on the Discovery ship sequence, yep. Even to the point of the red eye, which Kubrick uses so ominously in the scene where, you know, the astronaut is killed and the pod comes to camera and there's this big red eye. So I respected its kind of pedigree, but I thought that it was a little toy-like in this execution, and it wasn't as menacing. It had one really great angle from the front. That kind of facial appearance was really exciting, but I thought the side and you know, the other views weren't as strong. So for me, I kind of felt like it needed to somehow be more menacing. Now, that said, you know, the fact that they went with white, it's kind of counterintuitive. I respect the decision. You know, I think that the complexity of it was about right, given the technological thing. But at the same time, you know, to fix it, you just pop a lid off and change a pipe, and it seemed to be good to go. And so I kind of felt like it wasn't quite.
Well, assuming you had chewing gum.
Exactly. And I think also, and again, we've already said this is going to have spoilers, but one interesting thing was that that one of the early lines from the air traffic controller woman that Matt was you know, kind of agitated by was that there wasn't enough parts. You know, that they were saying, you know, we don't have enough replacement parts. And in the beginning, I was thinking, well, you know, if you had these drones protecting the most valuable things that you had, you'd have 100 million of them. You wouldn't have like 18, you know what I mean? So that kind of tipped the hand of the filmmaker to me a little bit. I started thinking, well, there's something not quite right about the story. And as far as the big evaporating things, you know, from what you could see of them, they had a nice scale to them, and they were kind of simplistic in design. And I also, just to make a little sense of my earlier statement about the ending, is I respected it that they were trying to do, that the director was trying to do something different, and the production designer, Darren Gifford, were trying to do something, you know, new and kind of minimalistic. I just felt to me that with the setup to going out there was such a pivotal moment in the storyline that my expectations, you know, grew with regards to the meatiness of the moment. Like, now we're going to go, you know, sneak in to the headquarters of the enemy and destroy them. And I think that some of the minimalistic things that had functioned with the design sense of the building that Tom Cruise lives in and the bubble ship and so forth, it just was a little underwhelming on that kind of cosmic scale. So that's my big
I do totally agree with you about that plot point, which was not having enough parts, not having enough drones. Just seemed, well, why were they spending all this time making more jacks up in the mothership, and why did they have so many resources in the mothership and not devote some more down on the ground? That seemed like a completely unresolved point to me. But Matt, from a visual effects point of view, what did you think? Because I thought the drones seemed like a nice, smaller version of the same tech that was in the bubble ship. And so I was a bit more forgiving on those drones. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, from a visual effects point of view, I think, you know, overall, the visual effects in this film from the companies involved, I think it's really strong. It's strong work. It's very consistent throughout. And I can talk about it later. There's only maybe one or two really small things that I saw that I had a little trouble with. But the other thing too that I think really helps this film, as well as that a good significant portion of the plate photography and location photography was done, I believe, in Iceland, right? And I spent a better part of a month of a summer, not this last summer, but the summer before, in Iceland. And I mean, it's really, and then of course, you know, there was a lot of stuff shot in Iceland for Prometheus as well, right? And I think that landscape, you know, now it's going to be hard for people to go back and utilize it again, but that landscape with, you know, the visual effects and the production design inserted into the context of that kind of otherworldly context, I think was definitely a different kind of visual. And it was, you know, in terms of the aesthetic, aside from what you'd seen in Prometheus, you know, I know we were talking about this earlier, it was like, it's another one of those big land grabs, you know, in terms of an aesthetic style where it's like, you know, the clean, white sort of, you know, almost like a, you know, a Johnny Ive, you know, future design with the bubble ship, the white kind of, Tom Cruise costume, the white spheres and the big hydro rigs and stuff. But I think overall the effects were really great, and the insertion of them into those vistas was really strong. I really love the, in particular with the hydro rigs, maybe not so much sort of that upside down kind of weird pyramid shape, but I loved the what little you got to see of the water being drawn up, the huge dynamic fluid dynamic simulations, and all the aeration of that kind of water where it's so sort of stirred up and, you know, filled with a lot, it's oxygenated, right? Like there's a lot of bubbles in that water, and the scale of that I thought was just really magnificent. And I wanted the camera to stop and just let me look at that for a while, because I thought it was such a really strong looking sim. And I think overall the work that was really, really strong.
Yeah, I think there are some interesting, you know, problem plot things we could get into, like why did the mothership have such a terrific aesthetic design sense when producing stations for everybody? You know, did it have a flair for interior design? But I do think that if we go away from those which are plot points to just implementation points, the hydro rigs and the bubble ship and the menacing pods, the, what do you call them? The
drones.
Drones, thank you. They did, you know, they did tie in more than just color, and they weren't just that they were all circular. They felt they were suitably aged and damaged and, you know,
well, they shared a similar
detailed
design language for sure, right? Yeah. I mean, they really did feel like they came from a similar hand, I thought.
So I want to switch now from those to discussing environments for a second, because again, leaving away the sort of the logic of the world, but just the visual effects, like there are a lot of really nice elements in this. I thought, for example, the representation of the moon having been shattered, and I thought it was a valid plot point as well, but, you know, it would cause huge amounts of problems. But I mean, it was a nice old worldy looking visual effect shot. I can imagine someone doing a matte painting like that.
Totally, yeah.
And it had a certain authenticity because they didn't overplay it. They didn't fly up to the moon and around the back of it to show it all busted apart. I felt there was, you know, all you needed to do was see that up there. You didn't have to have, I think in Transformers you'd have had a point of view shot of the Earth from over the top of the rubble, and then you realized it was the moon, and then, you know, you'd have flipped back around again kind of thing. And
to that point too, if I could just jump in, like the other thing I think that's so successful about the moon in particular and the way that it was articulated was there was that one kind of first time where you see it when they talk about the moon being destroyed, and you sort of see the moon in the sky, and you get, it's kind of full frame, it's like a big vista where you kind of see, it's almost, it looks like it's, you know, like frozen in this, you know, action moment, but you realize, oh no, it's like, you know, it's still in its orbit, and there's this sort of, you know, gravity, but it's been shattered and pieces of it, you know, have were propelled away, and then they sort of decelerated, and now they're kind of in their sort of weird other geosynchronous kind of state. And you saw that one huge vista, and then you didn't really see it again until later, and the next time you saw it, it was even minimized, it was sort of like, you know, it was at its, what is the, what is it in space terms, orbital terms, like the, is it the azimuth, right, is the greatest distance, or is that perigee, is that, I can't remember which one's which, but I don't know, but it looked like it was at its furthest distance, you know, like high in the sky where it's not like sort of harvest moon or something where it's really big, it appears really big at the horizon, but it looked like it was, you know, at a great distance, and then you saw really an expanse of the ring of debris in the moon. So I thought that that was really, and again, yeah, it wasn't really moving, so you could imagine it almost being like an old school, you know, painting on glass or something. I mean, it was really, I thought, super well done and a really neat aesthetic that wasn't overutilized. So yeah, I'm concurring with you, but that was something I really loved.
What about you, Ty?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the environmental stuff was really, you know, top notch as well. I mean, I think the moon, as Matt was just discussing, I kind of saw it the same way. And I think that, you know, a lot of the cinematic choices about what was left as debris, you know, what was left over from, and you can always quarrel with, well, what would be left after an apocalyptic event? And, you know, so if you want to do that kind of thinking, you know, there's a million ways you could go with it. But I think given the kind of the way that the story was set up and the kind of the this idea that Tom Cruise had this kind of crazy little oasis where he'd cobbled together this little nirvana for himself by a lake, that actually could kind of coexist with this, you know, destroyed, you know, city, which is just kind of basically bones sticking up out of the earth. I mean, I felt like there was because it also spoke about the Earth's ability to heal itself and to rejuvenate, and that was a little bit of a sub theme. You know, he brings that plant back or whatever. So I felt like, you know, in a different film, that could be, you know, conflicting. You might go, well, I don't buy it. But in this film, I thought that it was handled deftly, and you could kind of almost draw like a map, like in your mind, you could sort of follow the actions on the view screens from, you know, the air traffic control thing and say, okay, well, these zones were affected more fully than this zone. And I felt like they did a great job of kind of balancing out the environments. And I will say that it was funny because earlier you were kind of saying it was a little of this and a little of that. And to me, a lot of the moments were very much a kind of pedigree back to the 70s in, you know, like Logan's Run, for example, yep. Where you have all these, you know, these iconic, you know, images of the contemporary world in kind of in disarray, right? And those little reveals of, oh, this was really the Chrysler Building or whatever the case may be, that kind of, and again, of course, it's very interesting because it reminded me a lot of, you know, like the end of Planet of the Apes, for example. And yep. Even a little Soylent Green action. I mean, those 70s science fiction films, if anything, that kind of whetted my appetite for, you know, one of those moments where, you know, Soylent Green is people and you're kind of, or like the reveal of the Statue of Liberty at the end of Planet of the Apes, where you just, it jars you in such a, you know, unexpected and powerful way. And, you know, maybe a lot of that stuff is kind of been done. And you know, I think that that's sort of where my mind went, was hoping for something that was going to pull it together. But I digress.
I think as an audience member, you just enjoy those little moments as well. Like, I mean, let's not oversell them, I guess, but, you know, because they're obviously not necessarily furthering the plot a lot. But when you see something and then you realize what it was, oh, yeah, that's, you know, X, there is like a kind of, you take interest looking around the screen. So I actually find it fun when there are those sorts of things, like, oh, that's the whatever building or that's whatever. Oh, do you see what that is? You know, there are those submarines that he's riding the motorbike through and stuff. And it gave it a big feel, a big kind of production feel. And it was kind of fun as an audience member to sort of identify things.
Well, that's a big thing about this film, too. Like, if you think about the visual play of the movie, the world in which they exist, you know, you understand it in some strange way in terms of the geography. But think of how many shots in this film are just, like, they're huge vistas where you feel like you can see at, you know, a great distance. I mean, it's definitely, like, the landscape is another character in the movie for sure. And I think it's really interesting how those things, just how big the effort in terms of the visually capturing all that stuff, the scope of what they were trying to achieve, I think is interesting.
You know, I as you were speaking there, I was thinking, and this is probably an absurd thing to say, but it struck me that it's kind of a small cast. You could actually mount a stage play of this if you had twin actors for the lead so you could solve some of the later problems. You know, you wouldn't need to see a lot of this stuff on a stage play. You could get away with, you know, a lot of stuff because a lot of the action, a lot of the discussion, a lot of the stuff that's going on is played out between a relatively small number of casts. It's not like you've got massive, mega fight scenes that go on forever. So the visual effects give it all of its epicness, all of its kind of grandeur and its disappointment. One more environment I just want to touch on before we go too far away is there is the sequence where he goes into an actual kind of city when he's searching for the drone that leads him down into the public library and the trap. And I thought that was it's ground we've seen before, I guess, but I thought it was really well detailed, the above ground stuff. And then I didn't mind that they went below ground, and it didn't feel like a set. Like, I'm normally worried about those things that you go from really great expansive shots to, oh, okay, now we're no longer doing visual effect shots, we're in the studio and it feels kind of small. Well, however they filmed that sequence, it still felt big. It didn't feel kind of that we'd suddenly gone onto the soundstage and all the light
had changed. You mean in the library itself,
yeah,
when he descends? Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the first set piece where he's going down into the building.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought that was that. You're exactly right. I would have framed it the same way. It had the proper scale, as if you came in through the roof of something, and it felt very. It had that kind of organic feeling, like when you go into a cave or something, and you get a sense that that it's actually grounded in something other than scaffolding, like you're suggesting. It had a real. Kind of grounding of a foundation of believability, as it were, right?
Well, it even felt reminiscent of that, you know, that classic shot in Alien where Kane is being lowered sort of on a similar, you know, rig, right, down into the sort of the weird cavern where he eventually gets the thing on it, the face hugger on his face or whatever, right? But it had that same kind of vibe, well, not quite that same scale, but it was similarly framed, I think, as a set piece.
And I think it works in the story. Like, it's a dramatic problem, right? Like, you know, you have to go down in the hole. Don't go down the hole. You're going to go down the, you idiot, never go down in the hole. You know, you're bound to get in trouble. And it's claustrophobic without, as I say, looking like it was on a soundstage. And I thought it was good. Look, I like the film maybe more than anyone else on the show today, but I thought it was fun, and I was apprehensive with him being down there because I got to a very early screening of this, so I knew nothing about the film in terms of what the plot reveals were going to be. So I assumed that there were aliens down there and that they were going to try and eat his legs and, you know, gnaw on his elbows, and I was, get out of there. So I thought it was fun. And I didn't feel cheated either when reality was revealed later in the film. I mean, it was obviously they were playing with me and there were obviously some big cheats, especially in that sequence looking back. But nevertheless, it was good. You know, and I say we've done some stuff like that before. What was the film with... set in New York with the virus that, he goes into the building and the...
I Am Legend?
Yes, I Am Legend, exactly. And that was that kind of feel, right? Going into the building with the darkness. But
yeah,
it wasn't as dark as in that, so I felt less manipulated, I guess. You know, you could see around enough to kind of not feel like I was in a horror flick where they were deliberately stacking the deck against you. Talk about the implementation of some of the other stuff?
Sure.
In particular... I want to talk about the implementation of the bubble ship and the bubble ship station or the sleeping quarter station. The bubble ship itself, we've discussed how much we liked it from a design point of view, but Matt, maybe we should discuss it from an implementation point of view. People often say they like to see things done for real as much as possible. This was a great mix of doing it as much as you can to get the realism, but of course it's not realistic because there's no such thing as a flying ship.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely the, you know, the real... prop, right? There was that video that, I mean, I kind of am jealous a little bit of you, Mike, saying that you saw it really with almost no knowledge going in, getting sort of an early screening of it. I wish I had had that opportunity to see it. There is a part of me that thinks that it might have been a more interesting film had I not been, you know, somebody who'd seen the commercials on TV and watched the trailer online, and, you know, and then I watched the video when they were sort of first looking over the bubble ship, the full finished prop, right? They got all the pieces and they assemble it. There was some, you know, video about it.
The behind the scenes.
Yeah, like the production or the studio released it early, you know, to kind of build the hype about, oh, they fucking really built that thing, you know, and but I mean, it was amazing looking, right? I mean, it's incredible aesthetic. And then, you know, they built several different parts, right? They built the sort of gimbaled rig for when he's flying around, and a lot of that was done just, you know, against a blue screen, right? And then so they got, you know, sort of him actually sort of with the cockpit that would kind of rotate based on, you know, trying to retain some level of orientation, I guess, I don't know how that would work exactly, I guess, reduce the G-forces of some of the moves that he was doing in the ship. And then he was in there with the actress, right, the Julia character, right, in the cockpit. She actually looked real, actually nauseous at times, which I imagine you would be sitting in that rig. But then, you know, compositing that in with the background, and there were several shots too where he, the ship was going through like a rain cloud, right? And there was, when he goes into the thunder and you saw the rain hitting the cockpit window and the storm clouds in the distance, and I thought that stuff was really strong. And then the whole thing with the Sky Tower itself, and then I know, Mike, you and you guys did a piece on FX Guide about how some of that stuff was actually built and how so much of what they achieved visually in that set was actually achieved in camera, which is kind of was, I really thought, I had no idea watching it, but it was totally mind-blowing, like, you know, seeing that they actually did it with what it's something like, I think they had like 20 some odd projectors, right, in the round, projecting everything onto screens, and then so they were getting all these real reflections and refracted light and stuff, both off the full model of the ship on the gangway or whatever, the landing pad, as well as all the surfaces inside the sort of, you know, uber modern, you know, kind of Apple-esque house that they had built there, and that stuff was just amazing.
I got to talk to Claudio for the interview on FX Guide as well as the visual effects supervisor. But yeah, it was 500 foot wide by 42 foot tall with 21 projectors aimed at it, and they had a bunch of clips. And as you'll hear in that interview, if you listen to it on FX Guide, it is. I kind of thought, well, maybe there would be a whole lot of problems from that because, you know, sometimes these things are too clever by half and they don't kind of work. And also, you know, I've heard the theory about doing this, and then what actually happens in reality is when you speak to somebody, they go, yeah, that none of that worked. We had to write them all out and start all over again. But in this case, they actually got it right from everything that I can ascertain. There were some shots, a couple, that were having to be augmented or rather amplified, which is a much easier problem. But yeah, the director worked with the DOP so that they actually got the skies right and they didn't come back and have to replace them all later with a different version. And this meant that you had actors walking around on a set with an amazing vista outside the glass, which was reflecting in all the mirrored surfaces. And it just sold it. But I think also it sold it for the actors. I mean, obviously Tom Cruise can act. But what an environment to be in. And also what an opportunity for the camera operator and everybody else to get really good framing, really good setups when you've got this incredible view in front of your eyes, not just in front of what's going to be on camera at the end of the day. And look, there's a couple of things, you know, about getting the levels right and some limits to how far you can take that technology. But I imagined that it would, you know, it could be a nightmare for resetting. But in fact, because they had a really good team running the projectors, if, you know, somebody wanted the sun, let's say at 3 o'clock instead of at 9 o'clock, they would just, you know, run forward, sync everything up. And by the time they'd moved the camera to the next setup, the sky had just, you know, miraculously changed to where they wanted it to be. And I've got to imagine for an actor who could otherwise be faced with the, you know, option of just a giant green screen, this has got to be a terrific, you know, environment upon which to work in. Ty, did you see these giant projector things? There's some footage we've got on the site showing sort of.
Yeah, I looked at it, and I love that kind of. I'm a big, you know, a sucker for that in camera stuff, whatever it is, because I think it speaks to a different kind of problem solving. You know what I mean? It's a type of problem solving that goes back to the beginnings of film, you know, so the pedigree.
It's old school.
It's really,
totally.
And it kind of, it's, I think it's cool whenever you can kind of stand on the shoulders of the, those that came before you. It sounds kind of corny, but it's somehow kind of miraculous in a way that you can take so many varied experts and so many varied fields and so many varied, you know, technologies, and whenever you can pull them together and it just kind of creates this greater than the sum of the parts thing. I always find that stuff exciting. And it's always, the innovation is always there. You know, when you look at rigs in general or, you know, moving heavy objects around, I love all that stuff because it's just its own kind of world of expertise. And, you know, I'm sure that it was one of those meetings at somewhere where people were discussing it and one camp was saying, well, you know, we can throw up green goods in there and we'll be able to pull this and extend that and make it work. And another group saying, but if we can do this, you can shoot it all day, all night. You're free to shoot it however you choose at any moment. It gives the director all that flexibility. And I just think that's got to be a plus for, you know, for everyone involved.
Eric Barber made a really good point when we were talking to him about that, because he was at that meeting that you're talking about. And he made some comment along the lines of, at the meeting, and I'm paraphrasing, was like, well, it'll be really good if you like it. But if you don't like it later, it's going to not be that easy to work with. And so I think it's actually, I'm going to give the director some real points here, because most people put off until the last minute having to make any decision. So, you know, Joseph would be within his rights to say, well, I might want to change it later and, you know, have a different sunset or something, so let's make it a green screen. If you can have the confidence and filmmaking ability to commit to stuff and commit properly and in an orderly fashion like they did, then I think you can do spectacular stuff like this. And yes, they were locked into those particular sunsets, but who cares, you know? They were good sunsets. Like, they got it right, and hence they got it right. And I mean, I think it was Zach Alexander, the guy that runs all the projection stuff, who's also one of those videos. You know, he's like, he's talking about it. But clearly, like, computerization and the ability to sync up cameras and projectors and the way we can film now with these really, you know, high-resolution epic cameras to get the footage so that it doesn't, you know, deteriorate. I mean, there's some good advances in technology, as you make the point, Ty. But at the end of the day, he's shooting up there at 800 ASA. I think he was like about somewhere around T2. So it's, you know, it's not way in the zone. Like, you'd obviously want a bit more light normally, especially in the days when you're shooting on film at 250 ISO. But I thought it looked really, really good, and it allowed him to get such great shots across the surfaces of things. You know, there'd be terrific reflections in those panels and stuff. And in just weird things that you would solve them with proper physically based lighting in CG, but all the set pieces just had the right kind of weird bounce on them and weird kind of reflections and glints.
It's cool how reality does that. That's what's so cool.
And
I
isn't
mean,
it
you
funny
know,
how
like,
it rings true, though? It so rings true when you're looking at it.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I think, you know, just the effort that went into doing those shots in that way, I think it was, you know, I can't think of, I don't know of a film that's been made, you know, on this scale, on this budget, with a key set piece in the narrative where there were this many shots where something like this was attempted. I can't think of another project, at least that I've heard of, where this was done. I mean, I thought it was just such a cool idea, and to execute it so well was really great. Now, that being said, there were two shots, and I was saying that there were two shots that I was going to, or well, there were some shots that I didn't think were so hot effects-wise, and there were two shots, and I have no idea, I'll confess, I don't know if they were utilizing either the projectors or if it was a green screen. It would be interesting to note this, but it was after the Tom Cruise character first comes back to his floating home with the woman Julia, when they first come back, and that he sort of comes to the door first, but it's the two of them have landed in the ship, and you see him in the foreground and then the Julia character slightly in the background, and she's sort of, I think, still in the ship, but he's walking towards the door. And then there's a second shot from the point of view of the forgive me, I forget her name, Victoria, was that her name? The redheaded woman that he was sort of his partner beforehand, I think. Right. She is, you're sort of seeing her like over her shoulder, and you see the Julia character coming towards them. And in those two setups in particular, the background lighting and then their lighting didn't match. Like, so the lighting that you see on the
On Victoria, you mean?
No, it was the lighting. The lighting that you saw on the projection or on the green screen. I don't know if it was projection or green screen. And then the lighting on from that facing out towards the exterior, the lighting on Tom Cruise and Julia, the characters, didn't match the lighting that was on the projection. And it really jumped out. Like it looked like what it was. It looked like they were inside of a set being lit, and then. It almost looked like they were being composited into the background, and it was just two shots, but they really stood out compared to all the other work, which I thought was super stellar. And I'd be really curious if anybody who worked on those shots, you know, forgive me for my critique, but you could also slam my critique and tell me you're wrong. They're lit perfectly correctly and make the case, but they jumped out at me as ones that didn't quite look right out of that whole sequence, and it was a little jarring, I thought. Seeing them because they, I don't know if you caught any of those, Mike or Ty, but those shots
see,
in particular.
See,
but.
My thing, okay, so now I'm going to really get geeky on lighting for a second, but you have an inherent problem. So I think this was great. I think it was really, really great.
Yeah.
And I think that the story was good, but where my geek thing comes from is if you were to construct that in your mind as a horseshoe, it wasn't quite that shape, but let's imagine it sort of a three-sided projected thing.
Mm-hmm.
A projected image doesn't have the dynamic range that the real sunlight does. So in the real sunlight world, you would have all of that light completely parallel hitting the set, and it would be incredibly strong where the sun was because it would have all the dynamic range of the sun. And there would be really not a lot of light coming in from the sides other than bouncing off the cloud type stuff. But generally speaking, it would be overwhelmed by the front light. Imagine standing at dawn on top of a cliff face facing the sun. Like, it's really glary and it's really bright. And that's down here at kind of a bit lower in the atmosphere. Now, on the horseshoe, you're getting light that's coming in from the front and then from 90 degrees left and right. And it's because the light... The projected images are acting like giant light panels. It's as if you put up a couple of huge light panels left and right, and so your fill to key ratios are way off. I mean, just a mile off. Now, that being said, if you're trying to film actors with realistic harsh lighting coming through, it would be as if somebody's got, a massive near dawn shot with headlights or, you know, a sort of a searchlight pummeling through. On their faces, and you would be very, very contrasty. All the shots of Victoria and stuff where she's sitting in a room looking out over towards the sun should be so bright as to, please, for the love of anything, pull the curtains because I can't see what I'm doing on this panel. But if you're lighting an actress that's a Hollywood actress, you would naturally balance your fill and your key lights. So for me, I just gave up on lighting realism and said, this looks great and our actors need to look great, and it's, you know, it's Tom Cruise. I don't expect him to be silhouetted where, of course, he would be silhouetted walking with his back to the sun on a platform that high up. I just bought that there was all this amazing kind of cool kind of bounce light. I mean, there were a couple of shots of the tower where it was kind of silhouetted, but, you know, it's a bit like in space, right? There's always a ridiculous amount of bounce light on the outside of spaceships, Ty, where, you know, clearly in space you're going to have a massive contrast ratio. I mean, do you agree with me that it, A, was completely wrong, and B, didn't matter, or... How did you feel?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lushness to the way that they were setting up all the shots in the future tech. The future tech to me was, it was almost like looking at, and the director has a history that leads back to television commercials. It almost had, and Matt was joking a minute ago about, you know, the Apple store. It had a kind of lush quality to it that was like catalog. It looked like a catalog, photography of a high-end home with a super sweet Bugatti sports car. I mean, that's the aesthetic. And it was, I suppose, you know, to to draw a greater contrast between the the horrible conditions on Earth and how man was trying to leave there to go off to live in space, and there was this little oasis, even with a pool that was not only a pool, it was a moon pool. You know, you could look through the glass. The construction of that would be pretty incredible. But so I bought it. I bought it as being partly about that. Those spaces were meant to be super sexy and super lush, and like a catalog spread is what kept me. And so to me, there was a slight falseness in hearing you describe it. I was thinking, yeah, but clearly I bought it because I was just thinking about, you know, that a photographer shooting a catalog spread because it had that richness to it.
I think it just doesn't matter when it isn't right as long as it sits in the story, and it was totally sitting in the story. So I think I totally applaud the way they did it. And I think, you know, it's an intellectual exercise to pick it apart, and it doesn't serve the purpose of the story to pick it apart because it looked good and it needed to look good. It needed to look very clean and aesthetically, as you say, contrasting. And I thought that pool stuff was suitably over the top and, you know,
it was like a Swedish like space movie or something. Yeah, at that point.
But it was a good shot.
It was cool. I dug it. I mean, it was neat.
But see, again, you know, like it was it was very 70s. Again, you know, it was it was that very over the top kind of science fiction fantasy that would have been in Omni magazine or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not just living in Sid Mead cool house. You got a swimming pool that's made of glass. You know, you can go in there and, you know, bubble around. So I think, and I don't want to sound
Sid Mead in the Apple store is so true.
I don't want to sound, I don't want to beat the rhythm of discontent, but even that shot of the swimming pool, it just increased my appetite for more stuff. I mean, like, I wanted to see that extended into the rest of the film and kind of amplified over the 2 hours. You know, it seemed to me that it really, the bubble ship and the cool environments that you're established in the beginning, you know, kind of they hit their visual mark at the 15-minute mark, at 15 minutes into the film. And, you know, that kind of then levels off and stays for the remainder of the film. And so in my mind, that telegraph, wow, I can't wait to the next thing. In another film, you know, in a different kind of summer movie, you would have had Tom Cruise crash the bubble ship so that he could get the Mach 25, you know, then that would have been the change out that would have happened at around the 40 minute mark. So that then you could have the Uber version of it for the latter half of the film. But they stuck to this kind of austere, palette of visual materials. And again, I think it just increased my appetite, so that when he started talking about going out into space, I was like, yeah, I want to see that. That's going to be mind-boggling, you know?
It's a bit like if that's what they do with the beach house, I can't wait to see what they do with the summer palace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it was, as you guys are talking about this, it made me think of one other thing that we haven't mentioned yet that I also think is really key to bring up, which I think was one of the strongest things in this film, was the sound design. I think the sound design in this movie was, for the robots, in particular, the weird droid sounds and the kind of the barking kind of, you know, sort of like weird squeaking, like, you know, kind of air horn type sounds they would make as they're sort of going through their machinations, deciding, you know, what to shoot and what not to shoot. I thought that stuff was just totally spectacular. The language that they kind of developed, this thing that had this kind of autonomy and this level of menace. I just love that stuff. I thought it really added a lot of really high-end production value to the visual effects as well, and really made them much stronger characters than they would have been without that sound design.
Yeah, it was M83, wasn't it, doing a lot of the tracks?
I think so, yeah.
And the director typically does come up with spectacularly good soundtrack stuff to his work. Because when I first saw it, none of the soundtrack stuff was released. And I think I hunted the band down and found some of their other tracks that made it onto my iPhone playlist. But yeah, no, I agree that the music and the sound design was really good. Hey, I was going to ask you about one other thing. The nature of this film is I don't know, it's like a, it's sci-fi and it's fantasy, and you know, we sort of don't necessarily have to buy into everything at every particular point. But you know, for me, the cinematography, the way that it kind of was shot, represented enough tricks that I was really, really into it. And I think it comes from the fact that Claudio Miranda has this reputation from when he did commercials and did a lot of sort of... I mean, he's done like really complicated Nike commercials, but also he's done a lot of feature films, which had a lot of very complicated camera rigs, you know, HDR, complicated stuff going on and stuff. I felt like there was enough tricks in this that it was really visually interesting, but it wasn't a tricksy film. And now there was some flight sequences, some chases through, you know, impossible kind of camera angle-y things that the bubble ship was going on. But I thought he should be given marks for having a level of constraint in that it wasn't a constrained camera, but he didn't do those things that I'm telling about, like the coming from the back of the moon or that kind of stuff. I don't know if I'm pitching this right, but it was interesting visually, but not tricksy visually for me in terms of the camera work. I'd just be interested in your opinions.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think overall, you know, you look at this film and Tron, you know, both the same director and same DP, the Tron Legacy, and I think that, you know, visually, stylistically, I think Tron had much more kind of exotic camera moves, at least in some of the more action-oriented sequences. I did think the one, but I would concur. I think, you know, the visual style across the board and the physicality of the camera, even when it was a virtual camera, in almost every sequence kind of stayed within the same sort of cinematic language, I thought, and worked well in kind of conveying both the world and telling the story in a way that never really took you out of it, except for maybe in one sequence for me that, you know, was kind of a key, I guess, set piece sequence, which is the one where, you know, I guess you sort of saw it coming, but I didn't really feel like it had the payoff that I think it was going for, which was the and there were some great effects in it as well, but believability was strained in the big shootout chase between the bubble ship and the, I believe, three or four of the drones that were sort of chasing back and forth. And that, at least for me, I think visual effects wise, I thought, you know, there wasn't anything that really stood out, but I thought that it took it into a different language in terms of the speed, the motion, and then the sort of, because it was a kind of a set piece action sequence, and so it kind of stepped into another language for me.
I think that's a good point, and I felt that if I'm understanding what you're pointing out, Matt, I think I felt it also in the second drone kind of annihilation sequence when they're all, you know, the Earth-dwelling humans are set to launch this attack, and some of the couple of the drones get inside their facility.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And
the Raven's Rock sequence?
Excuse me?
The Raven's Rock sequence?
Yes.
When they get into the camp?
They get into the camp. And I think it was, I can understand in the story arc to create this moment of, you know, where hopes are high, and then, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men, right? I mean, everything kind of goes to ash in that moment, and there's this huge kind of, you know, fumble of some kind where things, you know, don't play out correctly. So I understood it, but there was almost like an arcade quality, I thought, to that end sequence where the gunfire and the kinetic nature of the motion and the humans just kind of being obliterated. It was very different than the kind of more what I would describe as naturalistic kind of. And I'm not sure for me that was a negative, but I was conscious of it. The thing I felt was I was disoriented in the context of a film that actually I think was pretty grounded in keeping me as the viewer like placed in space and time. And then this attack towards the end, it kind of surprised me that it was so, well, it felt long. I'm not sure if it was long in running minutes, but it just felt like, you know, like, wow, we've got these things in here now. How many cool ways can we fly them around and have everybody, you know, get shot? And so it just felt out of sync with the larger picture. If that's what you're pointing at, I would say, yeah. And I think it was in that sequence as well, which are kind of the action pieces.
Yeah.
Do you know what's interesting, though? While I don't disagree with your sentiment, I could have come at that from 180 degrees and said, the thing I really liked about the drone attack sequence in Raven's Rock is it didn't feel computer gamey from a rendering point of view, because that's a fully CG sequence, or at least there are huge sequences in that that are fully CG, like, you know, 500-frame fly-throughs with, you know, stuff flying everywhere and explosions.
And that's all just digital domain, right?
It's just a completely animated, yeah, it's like a animated, you know, Pixar thing. Like, it's just an Ice Age. Like, it's just none of that's live action.
That's a good point,
yeah. And the rendering is so good.
That's crazy because, yeah, it's like a gritty, I guess, you know, the camera movement through some of those environments really does sort of maybe give that away. I never really thought of it when I was watching it. But, yeah, I actually, as I was watching it, had no idea that that was a fully computer-generated environment. It felt like it was a real space, although... you know, if I had watched it again and thought about it, it would probably have dawned on me. But just given the way in which you kind of follow the drone through that environment, but yeah, that actually is a pretty impressive feat in that respect.
I mean, in that 500 frame sequence, there are a couple of sections down on the ground where that gunner unit is that Morgan Freeman climbs into. They're real, but so it's not like entirely. But there are. Sections of that and sequences and part of that are just 100% fully CG. And now, so I agree with you on the camera angle and the stylistic change. That's all true. But it's ironic that you use the word arcade, because normally what I would have said in years gone by is when we go to the fully CG sequences, they just feel more like a computer game and less real. But I don't think that we've got that problem anymore. I think that a company like DD can just make a action sequence like that real. Now, whether it has a camera move that also rings true and a visual sort of language that sort of also rings true, it's certainly the case that they produce some spectacularly photoreal-looking kind of explosions, sparks,
oh my
bombs,
God, yeah.
Blasts, guns.
Well, and all the sort of the dingy kind of world in which that's taking place, all the materials and textures and, you know, the reflection of, you know, puddles on the ground and stuff like that. I mean, it's definitely like, you know, if you're watching it and you're just sort of looking at that sequence and you actually have that, I'm looking at it right now, so I should confess that I'm actually rewatching it here on Effects Guide. There's a little Inside Oblivion feature that I think was Ian's byline or something, but it's a... that 500 frame shot is sort of broken down by DD, and you see a lot of those bits and pieces in here. And I mean, it is, looking at it again, I mean, I'm actually kind of astounded. It's pretty impressive. Yeah. It's really solid, like really. And there's that bit where the drone spins around and it bumps into the wall, and the physics of that movement and that sort of bump, and then the kind of that chaos of it kind of navigating through this, you know, darkened space and clunking against the wall. I remember seeing that in the film being, oh, that's cool. They had it kind of like, you know, like it's so disoriented, like being in this space, it kind of ran into the wall. But yeah, it's cool seeing that. It's really good.
It's interesting, Ty, because your realism barometer is coming from the visual language, I think, not from the rendering. Am I reading that right?
No, exactly. I'm not sure that this is a point I would have even brought up this evening. I was just saying that I recall feeling as though I had shifted into a different movie, and it was just, it wasn't anything to do with the spectacular visuals. It was just the tempo. It seemed like some of the shot choices and things were. But of course, you know, this is one of those moments where I'm reflecting on it, and it wasn't something that took me out of the film. It was just something I noticed, you know, that it struck me that it had a sense of being different than the larger picture. And I will say, just because now I'm wondering about that and trying to process it more completely, that, you know, I think that I wasn't expecting a set piece there. I mean, I wasn't expecting to have the drones come in. I was already kind of on the trip to go into space in my mind, you know.
Right.
And so this, it kind of seemed like, you know, it was superimposed on the movie. And so that's the kind of the sensation I got. And I think that it may have been a combination of things that maybe made it seem like it kind of stood out. But that might have been exactly the intentions. I'm sure it is that, you know, the director had in mind was he was going to throw in something that was going to you know, change the tempo of the picture in some way. And it was brilliantly done. I mean, I was totally mesmerized for those minutes. But that's why it might have seemed long also, is maybe it was just, you know, mesmerizing or visually stimulating in a way that made me address the time, you know, in a slightly different manner conceptually, intellectually.
Hey, Tom, let me ask you this, because I've commented in the past that I think work by companies like Band from the Ranch and stuff in doing screen graphics never really gets the attention that it deserves, given that I've tried doing those in my career and they're really hard to make look believable, realistic and cool all at the same time. Would you like to comment, because we've got also in that same article stuff on the Sky Tower interfaces and the design work that was done on the displays, and a lot of it was, you know, Cinema 4D and After Effects type work. It's not that it's technologically, you know, pushing the boundaries of what can be done, but I was just curious from a design point of view, did you feel like the language, the on-screen graphics, that kind of stuff worked for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because that now has become a bit of a trope, right? I mean, you have these kind of table displays and people are interacting with them. And, you know, there's even with Heads Up, you know, you don't need to describe it to the audience anymore. Its novelty is long gone. So you could practically bring up a Heads Up display and have an actor tapping at nothing. For no reason, with no technology at all, you know, whether it's happening in a set of glasses they're wearing or it's happening in some kind of projection, it's become kind of ubiquitous to the whole kind of science fiction genre. But in this case, I thought they did a particularly nice job of sort of showing how the operator was making decisions, and you as a viewer could at least get enough of a sense of the story, like, oh, okay, there's a map. She grabs a drone at one point, I think, and slides it across with her finger and, you know, releases it in another area. And you're thinking, okay, well, that just told that thing to go fly there. And I think that it seemed, again, I think on the way that it was presented as how the technology was operating, it seemed very solid. From an art direction standpoint, they did an awesome job again of kind of tying it into that whole, future that's that kind of glitzy, glossy yeah. catalog future. And it almost like she could have reached one, she could have moved the drones, right? And then just reached over and like changed the volume on the soundtrack. And you would have been like, yeah, it's great. And then dim the lights, you know, I mean, it had that bachelor pad kind of thing going on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Turn the whirlpool on with a little slider. And that stuff's been done and done. And it is difficult to have it look fresh. And I suspect, it's already in your iPad. You know, I mean, you look at your own iPad and you can bring up applications that you're dealing with that are very based on, you know, ergonomics and based on user interface. And yet they're more and more free to make them look however. So I realized what was happening, and I thought it was done tastefully, and it fit the larger picture, and, you know, it was...
Because I will say, if Victoria didn't look like she was doing something that somehow the audience would buy, then we'd have had a huge, what the hell was Victoria there for, other than to be the person that caused problems when Jack discovered... You know what I mean? Like, you had to give her something to do, otherwise it would have been a real sort of...
Yeah, I mean, they definitely tied it in with the whole notion of duality, you know, that they were partners, they had their own tasks, you know, she was sort of the brains of the operation, he was more the guy on the working wrench swinger kind of dude. And I didn't have any issues like about her redundancy. I mean, it seemed like a pretty... The only thing that concerned me is if he were caught, she didn't seem to have any ability to affect, you know, a rescue. And I thought there was also a few shots, and I don't want to even pick on it, but there was a few shots where she was getting feed that was of Tom Cruise's character in a certain place. And I was like, and you always do, it's like, well, where's that camera? And like, who's shooting that? You know, like, is it a satellite field? Or because, you know, she'll say, well, you know, it's, we're going to lose our ability to see you soon. Well, I don't know. But see, it doesn't matter because, again, you know, it was a sort of consistency to all that I much like the lighting conversation, I bought into it, and I was, you know, I was enjoying it for, and again, because now I'm the broken drum of the evening, you know, my expectation only amplified when I started seeing like, wow, what's going to, you know, come next, you know, that kind of a thing was playing in my mind.
Well, I have to say, as much as I respect both of you enormously, you haven't shifted my position. I stay where I started, which was I actually liked this film quite a lot. And the more we discussed it, the more I recalled shots that I liked. I also just thought it was clean work for DD to be doing. Like, DD's had some bad press and stuff, and here they are doing just good old-fashioned, hardcore sci-fi work and doing it very, very well in the way that only a competent company that's kind of got good staff can do. So I wanted to like the film for the reasons that you guys gave. I also wanted to like it because I like DD. I've kind of got a soft spot for them.
Yeah,
I was
really glad. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great setup. And I was going to come back and just say, you know, I got to confess, like, it's so much fun talking with you guys about this picture. And if anything, I would say, like, you know, I kind of feel like I hear what I've been saying, and then I hear what both of you guys have been saying, and I realize that there are elements of this that I think I probably like more than I said at the beginning, although I think overall I'd stick with my original comments. But I would say that I do really think I like, and I'm excited to see what... I think he's an interesting filmmaker, Joseph Kosinski, and I hope he gets to make more movies, if for no other reason than I'd like to see more of sort of these worlds that he seems to be interested in articulating visually, because I think he puts together a great team across the board, from, you know, cinematographer to visual effects to actors and production designers and all that good stuff. And so I'd be really curious to see more from this filmmaker.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with you. I do solidly wonder, like, I think Eric, the visual effects supervisor, deserves an enormous amount of credit. I have no idea, just don't know. But I'd love to know, you know, because the visual effects were such the source that I loved about this story, and the meat of the story probably wasn't, you know, that sort of great in some respects. You know, do I want to see more things that Eric does, or do I think more things that Joseph does? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that's fair question, yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, Digital Domain on a good day is, you know, and I'm thinking back to Benjamin Button and stuff, is just can produce great work. And I wonder, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it was the same team virtually on Tron, but you never know, right? But I guess the great thing is these guys do work as a team. I mean, there is loyalty there. They have worked as a team. They know each other well. Does it matter who gets the credit? If the team does good work, you know, is that not enough?
Yeah, well, and I guess I would say in that respect too, though, like, you know, if I say I want to see more films from Joseph Kosinski, I mean, I think, yeah, I would think it goes without saying that it's like, you know, it's a team effort. Like, I mean, filmmaking, yeah, by definition is a collaborative art form, so, yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't mean to be negative on your point there. So, Ty, any last thoughts?
No, I mean, I think that definitely it's a theater. It's a great movie to see. I think Matt said earlier, like, it's a great matinee film. I think seeing it on a big screen, it really holds up. It's got an epic quality. If you got a soft spot for science fiction, I mean, it has. It's trying to make science fiction with a capital S, right? And you know, I think that I have to say that I'm becoming more and more aware as I've gotten older, and especially talking with younger filmmakers that I have an opportunity to meet, you know, professionally, that, you know, I've been seeing movies for a long time, and each person's viewing appetite kind of creates a foundation within them. You know, the things that they choose to see, the things that they've seen, you know, at various key moments of their life when they're younger, when they're in the kind of rich puberty era, you know, when they see them when they're in college, where they see them, they kind of build up this foundational view of the cinematic language, and that by default creates certain filters. So I think oftentimes a person's expectations will color their, you know, view of a film that may not match even their own ability to see it or articulate it. And I think this might be one of those pictures where, you know, I think given the films that I've been attracted to and seen, may, you know, color something in a slightly different hue than somebody else is seeing it. So that's a quality you want to have in a film. You want people to have a variety of takes on it. And I'm certainly in Matt's camp. I'd love to see more from this director and his team. And I mean, this is his second feature film, right? And it's already, yeah. You know, there is a quality about it that's reaching. You can see it. This is a director who's trying to go somewhere. And yeah, that's the kind of thing I'm into. So I'll be excited.
Yeah, I definitely think you could have had a director play it much more for tentpole-y kind of stuff that I would have been really disappointed over. So I don't know, maybe I've had my sights lowered in terms of sci-fi stuff, that if anyone makes something halfway decent, I leap at it and embrace it. But I guess I'm going to have some good leaping and embracing opportunities looking forward, right? We've got Man of Steel, Pac Rim, Star Trek in a week or two.
Elysium.
I don't know when the US release of Star Trek is, but I know it's next week for me. I love this trend you Americans have of releasing your films earlier in Australia. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Very kind of you. And I really appreciate you guys being on the show. Ty and Matt, it's always a pleasure to talk films with you. We love having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, here, pleasure. Here, yeah, thank you.
So, Ty, if there's somewhere that somebody wanted to follow you on Twitter or go to a website or anything, where would they go?
My personal website is alieninsect.com. You can see some of my professional work, and there's a little button to mail me. Or you can catch me on Facebook, Ty Rubin.
And we really do appreciate you taking the time out to do stuff. And I know that you've been working on some very big projects lately, so thank you again. And Matt, what about you? Where can people follow you or contact you?
Yeah, I've been all over the place. I was up at Drexel University last weekend, and I'm usually at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, but summer just started, even though it's only spring. Summer just started for me today, so I'm not back at VCU until August, but you can always find out about – I gave a TEDx talk, by the way, last month, which was really awesome.
How'd that go?
Oh, it was the most nerve-wracking thing I've ever done, I think, only because –
Can we see it anywhere or –
I'm told that it is being all of the talks from it was a TEDx, so it was an independently set up TED event, and it was done in Richmond, Virginia, which is where VCU is located, not far from where I live. And it was amazing. It was like a full day. There was a day before of rehearsals, and then a second day, which was the actual recording of the event. And it's basically all done essentially as a live thing, and they did a live stream, and then it's all recorded. And then what they do is, which I didn't really understand how all this worked, but the group that put it on is going to take all the material, and they edit everything and cut it all together and do all the separate subsections of each bit. And then they take all that edited content, and then they send it to the actual TED organization. And then the TED organization goes through all the material, and they make decisions about what they actually put on the on their site, on the national site. So the TEDx RVA, which is Richmond, Virginia event, has a website, which I believe is just TEDxRVA.com. I can't remember exactly, but there's a link to it on my website, which is MattWallen.com. But yeah, the TEDx talk thing was, we were showing off a software application tool thing that we've been working on at the university. And it was fun, but it was a nerve-wracking thing for sure. I'm not usually one to get nervous doing public speaking, but that one was a weird one somehow for me, but it was fun nonetheless. And a lot of really interesting talks that day.
So just to be clear, did you say that it is available to watch on your website?
Well, you can't watch it on my website, but you can get to the link to the TEDxRVA, which I think is still a website that you can go to, TEDxRVA.com. And I think you can actually watch the entire event as like, but they don't have the like the recorded whole event. You can see the whole stream, but they haven't cut it into pieces yet. So you'd have to look through. I don't know.
Everyone always says their URL really quickly because they say it a million times. But it's MATTWALLIN.com.
Yes.
If you're trying to look for that.
Yeah. Thanks.
That's right. No, I mean I do it myself. Like FX, I don't know. What? You say it 100 million times, you expect everybody else in the world to know it. Hey, guys, it's been terrific having you on the show. I'm certainly looking forward to seeing if we can get you back on some of these amazing films coming up. We always love your perspective. And thank you guys so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Until next time, I'm Mike Simmel. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.